Welcome to Mysterious Universe Plus, Season 22, Episode 23. Coming up on the show, we've got The Caress of the Blue Woman, the Hito Bashira Death Pillars, and experiencing an awakening at the fried chicken restaurant. I'm Benjamin Grundy. Joining me is Aaron Wright.
I'm intrigued by you going into the story of The Caress of the Blue Woman. And the reason why I say that is because after I did all that research on the last episode for The Dark Side of Cupid and all these stories of people that have had seemingly odd interactions with entities associated with their lovers and having traumatic relationships, so much of the paranormal seems to be associated with human sex. It's like these entities are absolutely obsessed with it, whether it's on UFOs, slider phenomena falls in there. In fact, I was reading through some Hillary Evans work, and he remember that book he wrote called Sliders, which was about people that have streetlight interference.
They can turn off streetlights just by thinking about it or accidentally.
Or driving past them, they'll randomly turn off and they have, you know, weird activity with their watches. He found that in some of his research, slider phenomena would be right after people had sex. So people could have no slider activity at all. Then they'll get all into this amorous state and have sex. And in the following hour, maybe two afterwards, whenever they walked near any lighting, it would switch on or off. It was like this weird, electrical interference that came from the state of sex. And then I think, well, then that ties into things like Crowley and all of his weird sex magic. Is there something about human sex that attaches these or brings these entities to it?
Yes, yes, and yes.
Good, okay.
And this is all from Initiated by Matthew Roberts. It's a brand new book out. And the reason I wanted to go into it is he was on board the USS Theodore Roosevelt during the incident that eventually appeared in the gimbal footage.
Remember, the gimbal
footage was what was released or kind of leaked in that big New York Times expose that revealed the secret Pentagon UFO program.
Is it the tic-tac footage? Is that
it's associated with that. It's not the Nimitz incident, but it's one of the ships that was involved in one of these, you know, infamous UFO videos now that kind of blew the lid on the whole secret UFO research program. Mm-hmm. And I think Tom DeLonge's Academy to the Stars was the first to get the footage, but then it was just everywhere. It was all over the place in 2017. Well, it turns out Matthew Roberts, again, he was on board the ship during this event. He has very close knowledge as to what actually happened because he's former naval intelligence.
How is he allowed to talk about it?
He doesn't. That's the thing. He doesn't talk about it, but he just happened to be involved. The fact that he doesn't talk about it doesn't destroy the story, though, because so often when you have someone that's involved with the UFO phenomenon, of course, we know on the show what comes with it, what accidentally gets packaged up with it, which is a lot of weirdness. And after this incident, he just had all this insanity enter his life.
Oh, so he can obviously talk about the flow-on effect, but not the actual event.
Well, it's a really, really strange book. And actually, before I go into it, I mean, you should share what you've got coming up because I've got quite a lot here and it's going to get pretty weird.
Oh, okay. Well, we'll see how we go then because I've got a couple of stories that kind of follow on in a different kind of direction from The Dark Side of Cupid. But as I was saying there, as I started digging deeper into this, I just found so many incidences of people that have had, and obviously, unfortunately, it's a lot of it's just from forum sources, but people claiming strange events that have taken place after they've had sex. It's like people have said that, you know, after having sex, I'll have dreams where these entities come and rape them afterwards, but these entities then start appearing in their waking lives and ducking out from behind pillars and from behind, you know, if they see them from the corner of their eye.
Yeah.
All the way, as I said, to the streetlight interference kind of stuff. But it all ties into this idea of the entities that are attracted to human sexuality. And so there's all these stories that, of course, you know, many of them we know, but how lovers' lanes seem to be associated with more activity of strange Bigfoot creatures or ghost-like, you know, apparitions. So going through all that, I ended up coming across a whole heap of experiences that people have had after being abducted by aliens and then having weird sex going on, which somehow ties in with the death pillars of Japan. So I thought, this is just crazy and nuts. So I know that you've got a lot. So let's see how we go, because maybe I'll do the Hito Bashira later on and we'll just see where we get.
Okay. Well, this had a foreword by Terry Lovelace.
Oh, okay.
And Terry Lovelace wrote the book, The Devil's Den, which we featured on an episode, I think this year or late last year. And it was a fantastic story. Terry was an assistant attorney general. He was a former US Air Force veteran. And apparently him coming forward with his experiences, because he spoke about, you know, childhood abduction experiences, implants, so and all of sorts of weirdness.
Yeah.
Apparently Matthew Roberts, the author of this book, the former naval guy, read that and thought, oh, maybe I can talk about what happened to me. So in the foreword, Lovelace actually reveals a bit about Roberts' background. He is a 16-year veteran who served in the US Naval Intelligence Service. And he says, so important is Matthew's message that in March of 2020, he left the United States Navy for civilian life. He decided his ability to write and speak freely about face-to-face encounters outweighed his opportunity for personal gain and financial security. Because he apparently left before he reached his retirement age. And okay. I don't know what the package you get when you retire from naval intelligence is, but I imagine it's reasonably good.
Well, it'd probably be a pension for the remainder of your life.
That's right. So he basically gave that up in order to get this word out. And he writes, his message and its high cost proves the urgency in this matter is justified. He says, as we say in the legal community, time is of the essence, and perhaps in the entire history of humanity has that never been truer.
It's a pretty bold claim.
And again, Matthew was aboard the Theodore Roosevelt in 2015. He was part of a strike group or collection of naval warships, and he was on board during the events that brought us the now declassified gimbal and GoFast footage, which I'll link to in the show notes if you haven't seen them before, but you can basically go to Wikipedia and they've got all the videos up there. He refused, even after my encouragement, to talk about the events, though, the details of the events that led to the footage. Lovelace said, I respect that and consider him a patriot in that regard. Now, yeah, that's good, I guess. He's honouring his security oath.
Yes.
But you also left the Navy, get this message out.
I think it's...
Why wouldn't you talk about what happened?
Because it's probably more than honouring his security oath. It's probably that it's under threat of being jailed, under threat of heavy fine, anything that happened while he was in that job, he can't talk about it.
After the workups and subsequent deployment of the Theodore Roosevelt Strike Group, he transferred to his new duty station where he worked as an analyst at the Office of Naval Intelligence in Washington, D.C. It was during his time at the Office of Naval Intelligence that he began to experience personal experiences with the phenomenon. Now, I imagine to be in naval intelligence for, 15 years, you have to have your head switched on.
Psych screening,
yeah,
you know, psychological and psychometric testing, all that kind of stuff.
Very difficult to get in, and I imagine you have to be pretty high IQ and a pretty grounded individual to serve for that long and even make it in there.
You would think so.
So I was just intrigued by this possibility that this guy was just involved in that incident, and then had a wave of other stuff that occurred, maybe because of that, maybe just being on board one of those ships involved with the Nimitz incident or the other ship. It would trigger some kind of, you know, prying of the phenomenon into your life.
It's enough.
So it all started back in 2017, he said. He felt like he had life figured out. Robert said he knew what he was doing. He kind of knew what the future held, but soon everything was going to change. He woke up in the middle of the night a week prior, gasping for breath. And he said he couldn't get any air in. He just felt like he was suffocating. And in a panic, he scrambled to try and reach the phone for help, but ended up passing out, lost consciousness. His head hit the pillow. And he just had this wave of calm come over him as he lost consciousness. And he actually was fine. Like, he woke up the next morning, but he still had that real kind of tightness in his chest. And he felt like it was very, very hard to breathe. So he drives himself over to the emergency room on the base. And, he fills in the form and he's still finding it hard to breathe. But eventually he sees a doctor, and minutes later, the doctor comes back with a syringe. Like, they did a CT scan and took blood work. But immediately the doctor comes back with a big syringe and says, I have some bad news. It's pretty serious, but I have to give you this injection immediately or you will die.
What was the injection?
I'm not sure, but basically the doctor explained that he had massive blood clots in both his lungs.
Oh.
The doctor said, this injection I'm giving you is a blood thinner. There's an ambulance on the way that will transport you to the hospital. You're going to spend some time in the intensive care unit. And I want you to understand that this is incredibly serious and life-threatening, but we're going to do everything we can for you. So, you know, he just thought, oh, I've got a bit of tightness in my chest, but oh crap, this is a life and death moment. So he gets bundled into the ambulance and ultimately he recovers and he spends weeks in hospital recovering. But he had what's called a saddle pulmonary embolism. And really, he was moments away from dying.
Yeah, he did. Yep.
Now, he says, I don't remember much of my hospital stay. He said he mostly slept and didn't really eat anything, mostly unconscious, and had all these, you know, medical professionals hovering over him all the time. But he said one night a wire that was connected to a node on my chest came loose. He said I was awoken when a nurse came in and started pulling at the blanket I was wrapped in to get the loose wire. And he opened his eyes to the sight of this dark shadow standing at his bedside with only the light of the door open. And he suddenly had this reaction he didn't understand. He was absolutely terrified. She started tugging the blankets off him and he just had this rush of adrenaline and his heart started pumping and he could even see his heartbeat. Like he was just so scared. And the nurse kind of says, oh, are you okay? You look as white as a sheet. Are you feeling all right? And he's like, And she's saying, you know, can you breathe? Your heart rate's up. And he eventually says, yeah, I'm fine. You just scared me coming in the middle of the night. Sorry. She gives him some more oxygen and he starts to feel more comfortable. But this is the first kind of red flag that something wasn't right, because it wasn't normal for him to be this scared, to have this kind of reaction to just a nurse coming in the room and, you know, being there in the darkness.
Was he scared of her or was it of a feeling in the room?
It was just this feeling.
Mm.
And he didn't understand why he felt that way. So after he was discharged, he noticed more strange things going on. He started to notice an intense ringing in his ears. One of his ears felt irritated. He thought maybe he had some fluid in it or maybe an ear infection, but he didn't want to go back to the hospital. But then he found that apart from this ringing in the ears, he was hyper paranoid at night. He said the slightest creak in the house and he'd be jumping out of bed full of adrenaline, ready to fight. And he recalled having maybe a spell like this as a teenager, but had totally forgotten about it. In one instance, he actually jumped out of bed so terrified, he grabbed a baseball bat and headed down to the kitchen to, you know, confront an intruder, but it was just his dad making a sandwich. But the hyper paranoia was getting worse and he started to have these horrible nightmares as well. Terrifying dreams. And he would wake up covered in sweat, so bad that it looked like he'd just run a marathon or something. He had to change all his clothes. You know, all the sheets were soaked.
Is he having night terrors in conjunction with that?
Yeah, absolutely. Everything is this night terror almost every single night. Like, for instance, in one of them, he's in some strange cave hiding behind a boulder and there's a man in a white lab coat torturing a naked woman who's chained to a metal table. And all he can do is hide behind this rock in this cave, absolutely terrified. He's having other dreams where his parents are being hacked to death with an axe. It's just really puzzling because, you know, his mother passed away in 2015, but he doesn't understand where the trauma's coming from, like where the violent imagery is even coming from. It just doesn't make sense. He doesn't really watch movies or TV. He just doesn't understand where that's coming from in his psyche. He had no idea. So he started to consider that this pulmonary embolism he had, it just messed him up. He felt like his personality had changed. His ears were ringing all the time. And he had these bald spots on his face, like right near his neck. He had these two strange spots that hair didn't grow out of anymore. And they were really conspicuous. Like he'd look in the mirror and you could really tell there were just these two bald, naked spots of skin where his normal beard would be.
Some kind of weird localized alopecia or something.
Yeah, he just wasn't sure what the hell was going on. But all of this just added on top of the horrible, violent nightmares to making him just horribly depressed. And he thought, maybe those blood clots have just screwed with my head. Maybe the oxygen deprivation messed with my brain. Maybe this is my life now. And he just became severely depressed at the whole thought of the thing. Then one night in December 2017, as he's sitting there with his ears ringing, he starts to take stock of his life and he talks about how he lost his younger brother in 2010. His brother had colon cancer and died at the age of 29. It's kind of tragic. And again, his mother died in 2015. She had heart failure due to complications with Addison's disease. And he's kind of, you know, discussing his life. He kind of opens up a bit and says that he realizes he doesn't have any joy in his life. Like every day he just wakes up and thinks, I hate my life. Like I hate my job. I hate what I do. I don't have any joy. I don't have any fun. I don't enjoy doing anything. And, you know, he's got plenty of money and he always thought, well, I'll go and buy an expensive car. But then he'd always stop and go, I won't even enjoy that. I just don't enjoy anything. It's just a weird thing to kind of admit.
Well, kind
he
of.
Just doesn't enjoy a thing. He's just...
sounds like he has depression.
But it's almost like he admits that that's always been his life. Doesn't have any hobbies. He doesn't enjoy doing anything. He just...
Yeah, he's probably got depression.
He's a massive sad sack, basically. And this has all just kind of brought it into focus, everything that's going on. Now, he had just transferred to this new duty station at the Office of Naval Intelligence in Washington, D.C. And he'd only been there 6 months before he got sick and was thinking, you know, things aren't getting off to a good start. He was coming off another 3-year sea duty tour. And he's thought that he's thinking that maybe now that I'm back in D.C. and I'm not going out to sea anymore, I'll have a bit of time to work on myself. Like I'll have me time. But because he explains how he wasn't spiritual growing up and his family were basically all atheists, he didn't quite understand or know what working on me meant or even how to do it. He didn't know where to start because he just had no spiritual or even metaphysical thread in his life at all. His parents were both scientists and, you know, any kind of magical thinking was frowned upon in the household. Now, while pondering this, thinking, what the hell am I going to do? I don't know the first thing about improving myself. He looks down at his phone and he gets a text message from his brother. And he starts reading these messages and they start coming through. Like his brother's clearly excited. And his brother's texting him about this new article in the New York Times that's revealed this Pentagon UFO program. And he starts explaining in this text message that this footage has been released and that the former Senator Majority Leader Harry Reid is quoted in the article. And Roberts texts back his brother and says, yeah, I'll check it out. But he said secretly he did not want to have this conversation with his brother. This was something he said, I thought I definitely wouldn't be able to discuss. Now, eventually he reads the article, he watches the footage and his heart sinks because he realizes that, oh crap, I've seen this footage before. And he said he started to get emotional because it took him back to the memory of the experience. He said, I knew my brother would be calling any minute to ask me about it. And his heart starts pounding. He starts to actually panic because he doesn't know what he's going to say to his brother. He was thinking, you know, he'll just play it off and say, oh, it's probably nothing. But he went back to the article to try and make sense of why had this been released? Was it declassified? Could he even talk about it? Now, here again, he lays it out saying, I'd been present in the battle group when the footage was collected and remember the incident as though it were yesterday. And until this point in my career, work had always been work. It was a place where I was cool and calm and a collected professional, you know. But for me, this incident was different, he said. It was inexplicably very emotional. And I just stopped here and thought, why would it be emotional? Why is it emotional, this craft captured on footage?
And the other thing that raises a red flag there is you said, well, he doesn't know what he's going to say to his brother. I'm like, well, as an intelligence officer, you would already have a cover story. It'll be very natural. It would flow off your tongue to be able to, oh yeah, okay, bro, that's great. I know that you said that he was kind of playing it off, but the fact that he's even panicking and struggling to think, oh, what am I going to talk about?
Yeah, it just doesn't make sense. The whole thing with his heart going faster and him starting to panic, you really want to know what actually happened when they got this footage on that Navy warship.
Well, that's what I'm speculating about. I mean, perhaps it's inconsequential, but did he actually see the crafts with his natural eye?
Well, maybe, because he keeps saying, I remember the day vividly. And, you know, he's in naval intelligence. So any footage that came through, I'm sure.
Definitely would have seen that.
I probably would have seen it.
Yeah.
So I really want to know what happened. But listen to what else he said. He said, I was reliving the first time I had seen this footage as this encounter was unfolding. I'd found that the footage spoke to me on some level. As I studied it one day, I found tears were welling up in my eyes as though I knew something about it.
What?
But I didn't. He said I was unable to eat for several days and my appetite had disappeared completely. At one point, the thought entered my head that I had brought them here. Now, he said I was unable to shake this feeling because it was so powerful. And this feeling grew stronger and more intense as the events unfolded. I remember feeling afraid to sleep. The feeling they were there for me was unsettling. I felt guilty about it and worried that I would be found out. These thoughts entered my head, he said, for some unknown reason. And one day he said he walked past a couple of pilots who were talking about the incident. And as he kind of listened in on what they were discussing, he walked past them and tried to look down at the floor and sneak past them without being noticed. He said he was shaking with fear because he had the feeling that they might find out that he had something to do with the whole incident. He said, I couldn't understand this reaction I was having. It was nonsense, yet the emotion was very real. How could I feel this way? So this is really bizarre. I mean, maybe there's not too much to this whole incident where that footage was captured. I mean, I'm sure you've got the pilots who would share their stories on what they saw. Maybe people on board the warship saw things as well. But, you know, maybe it's not more than that. Maybe the whole point of this is that his reaction is so nonsensical. He just can't figure out why he's feeling this way. Why would you feel like it's your fault?
Yeah.
An aircraft from your aircraft carrier has seen a UFO. Why would you think that you've attracted them?
A small part of me is a little bit reluctant to buy into it, because we have seen with a number of people that claim to be abductees is that it becomes very narcissistic. They make it all about, no, it's about me, it's about me. And I'm thinking, well, is this what this guy has done? Is it just convenient for him because he was on one of the vessels that this is a way to get attention? Or is it genuinely that something did happen to him and he's terrified?
Well, the scenario that's coming to mind is that something has been happening to him, and this incident with the UFO has just been that kind of wedge into his consciousness.
Yeah.
That's gone, hello, wake up. Something's been going on with you. It's time to acknowledge it in your conscious mind.
So at this point, does he acknowledge that because you said that he grew up in a household of scientists and I guess atheism, does he actually have any recollections of strange events taking place throughout his childhood?
Not yet. Not at this stage. He's still trying to deal with these messages that his brother's sending him. And eventually his phone starts to ring and it's his brother and he has no idea what he's going to say. Eventually he has this, you know, horrible feeling in the pit of his stomach, but answers the phone and his brother says, hey, did you read the UFO article? And he says, yeah, I read it. It's pretty interesting. Have you ever encountered anything like that, bro? And his esophagus just tightens into a knot and he starts choking. He starts choking on the phone. He's like, he doesn't know what to say and he doesn't know why he feels this way. And there's this awkward pause where his brother's like, Matthew, are you there? And he says, yeah, I'm here. Have you ever encountered anything like this? And he kind of clears his throat and starts breathing. His heart's pounding out of his chest. And he eventually just says, yeah, I was there in the battle group when this particular footage was collected. And then there was a pause on his brother's end, just taking this in. But he had nothing else to say because he didn't know anything more than that.
But why would he even say that? Why would he even put himself into that position to say, oh, yeah, it's pretty cool?
Because he felt like that's what he wanted to do. But something happened where he just blurted it out. He couldn't help it. So he's spurred by this inexplicable emotion that he's feeling, this panic that's taking over his life. He finally starts to do some reading. So he describes picking up, The Hunt for Skinwalker. He picks up a bunch of Jacques Vallée books, The Invisible College, Confrontations. He reads the books that Tom DeLonge co-wrote, Secret Machines, and there was an earlier one, I think. He said, look, all of this was a wealth of knowledge.
But why would he go for books that focus on interdimensional phenomena? Like, why would you? I mean, maybe it's a coincidence, but wouldn't you focus on books that are about UFOs specifically?
Well, they're about UFOs as well.
Yeah, they are. But well, Jacques Vallée's work is, and obviously, DeLonge's is as well. But
that was Hunt for Skinwalker.
Yeah, it is. But Skinwalker is more, I would say it's kind of hardcore for someone who's just
Look, he doesn't know anything. He's just picking books. He's just like, oh, I got to find out. He has no idea. It's not like he's discerning which genre or subgenre to go into like we do. Mm. He's just like, I need to figure out what's going on. So he's reading about things that he thought only existed in the realm of tinfoil hats.
Yeah.
Stories of abduction, the loss of control of one's body, the feelings of an urge to get in your car and drive. Like it just, it felt kind of crazy to him. But there were some tales that stood out. There were some cases that stood out from Jacques Vallée's confrontations. There was one called The Happy Camp. And he kind of repeats it here in the book. He said the main event took place on November the 2nd, 1975, when Steve, Stan and Helen and two others were driving down a dirt trail. This is in the base of Carday Mountain. I don't know where this is. He doesn't include the data. And essentially they had a sighting earlier and they were trying to explore where they'd seen some craft. But they encounter this strange fog in the canyon and it forces them to turn back. And this is where they become totally confused about what happened to them. They remember heavy boulders falling off of cliffs and bouncing around their truck. They remember the door locks being opened and a strange being telling Steve, "You won't need that," when he started to reach for his gun. They believe they saw a hovering object. Helen recalls being lifted inside a room, but she's confused about the time sequence. One occupant had a dialogue with her in the course of which he described a transparent object as being made of gold. Helen answered that she knew what gold was like and it surely was not transparent. The being answered simply, "There is such a thing as gold that you can look through. It's in your Bible." Steve thinks he was in a craft with a transparent window on top and bottom, and he thought he was able to see China Mountain. Their next conscious memory is of driving down the mountain, singing a chorus of an old church song. The hymn they were singing was, "There is power in the blood of the Lamb." He's just like, okay, that's the weirdest encounter of anything I've ever heard before. But he was especially kind of confused at the mention of the Bible and this mention of transparent gold in the Bible. Because to Roberts, he was brought up as an atheist. Everything about religion was nonsense.
And superstition.
Every religion was silly to him and his family. So this really kind of important encounter with possibly an extraterrestrial, non-human entity situation, he felt like it was just ruined by this mention of the Bible. But he does try and find the passage to get to the bottom of it. He actually digs out a copy of the Bible and he finds it. It's in Revelation 21, where, "And there came unto me of the seven angels, and he carried me away in the spirit to a great and high mountain, and from showed me that great city, the holy Jerusalem, descending out of heaven from God." And later on it describes the city was pure gold, like unto clear glass. It's describing the gold clear glass, like the encounter. "And the 12 gates were 12 pearls. Every several gate was of one pearl. And the street of the city was pure gold, as it were transparent glass." So there really is these mentions in Revelation 21 about gold being transparent. Now, we've looked at Revelation 21 in the past because we covered the work of John Michel and the Dimensions of Paradise.
Yes.
And he understands that Revelation 21, yes, it does sound like some kind of unearthly experience, but its message is full of calculations. Its message is full of real measurements. And Michel brilliantly lays out how those measurements have to do with kind of a harmonic ratio and its sacred geometry. It's communicating a kind of order to the universe, a universal truth, if you will. And yes, it might be some kind of heavenly experience or even a interaction with higher beings recorded in the Bible, but it has this deeper message of...
Well, the mathematics even behind it is something that's almost tangible.
That's right. There's some kind of universal truth hidden within the story, but the way that Roberts interprets it, he's like, clearly they're describing going aboard an alien cube ship. So he's like, it's clear to me that's what's going on. It's a cube-shaped alien craft.
I wouldn't jump down that straight away, but you're right. I mean, even hearing it, it does have this kind of sound or ring to it that, maybe it could be a description, an abstract description of going aboard a craft.
Later on, he's alone at night and he's going through abduction stories. And he eventually comes across this checklist that you can go through to see if you think you might be an experiencer, if you think you might be an abductee. And he's like, oh, this is silly, but I may as well do it. So he starts going there through this list and starts to feel pretty uneasy because many of the questions are very, very familiar to him. It mentions blood type, blood clots, nightmares, hyper paranoia at night, and Addison's disease. Now, Addison's disease is a side effect of the constant tapping of the adrenal gland. And over time, the gland stops functioning properly. And that's how his mother died. His mother died from complications due to Addison's disease. So I don't know if he's already read about bloodline connections with these experiences, but it occurs to him that this might have something to do with me. And he's kind of realizing, no, it can't be. And his hands are shaking, his heart's pounding. And deep down, he knows it's true. Deep down, he realizes that I'm connected to this stuff in some way.
Well, it's even more than that, because he said that his parents were scientists. I'm beginning to think, what kind of scientific research were his parents doing and for whom?
Well, I don't know if we can go that far just yet, but what follows in the book is Roberts's mad quest to understand. It's like he discovers our library in our studio here and just reads nothing but, like, he just sits his ass down and reads every book we have in our library for 6 months straight.
Could you imagine the overload, though? No wonder. I mean, I know he's already experiencing paranoia, but by the end of that, he's going to be pretty messed up.
Well, I kind of had to skip ahead because it's kind of like stumbling across this stuff for the first time and then regurgitating it.
Sure, which most of you already know that.
Yeah, to people. So I kind of skipped over that. But eventually he's getting into Hermetic teachings and he comes across the Kabbalion by the Three Initiates, this book that came out in the early 1900s, published anonymously. And it's meant to reveal, you know, these heavenly secrets, I guess you could say. But as he was sitting there in his truck smoking, he said, he looks all this stuff up on his phone and he's just contemplating everything he's discovering. And he lets his eyes wander across the backyard and he's parked in front of this 3-foot chain link fence that encloses his backyard. And there's a stable that the previous owners had. And it's kind of on the edge of the property, but you can still see it from where he's parked. And in the doorway of the stable, he sees a shadow. And it looks like a very tall, thin, completely white person bending down to look out through the doorway, like a 8-foot tall, wiry thing, like bending down to look at him. And he's just fixated on this figure staring at him, trying to make sense of it. But for some reason, he just went back to playing with his phone. Like, he doesn't understand why. He just kept on looking at his phone.
There's some controls occurring here.
And he starts reading about the synopsis of the Kabbalion. And he thinks it sounds crazy. He's not really impressed with it. And it starts to talk about how there's no such thing as chance and everything happens for a reason. He's like, I'm not going to read that. That's ridiculous. He says, it didn't speak to me. Obviously, reading that will be a dead end. And he basically forgot about it. Now, the next day, he just experiences a ton of synchronicities. Like, everything about the day was a coincidence, from, you know, the clocks doing weird things to people mentioning things to songs on the radio.
All the classic stuff.
I won't bore you through all the synchronicities for him, but for him, it's like, oh my God, what a weird day. It was just like an entire day of synchronicity.
Is there a lot of 11-11 in there somewhere?
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff like that. Just a weird day of coincidences. And he's pondering this for a moment. And again, his heart starts beating really fast, like just pounding in his chest. And he looks down and he can see his shirt moving because his heart's going so hard.
That's not a good sign.
No. And it feels this incredibly uncomfortable. And he said it was like the kind of pounding that would happen after a hit of adrenaline. But I didn't feel any rush. There was just this weird pounding in my chest.
Or when there's a blockage from a clot.
He said my hands started to tremble and I sat on the edge of my bed trying to remain calm. But then all of a sudden, he said, this powerful urge surged through him. And the urge was saying to get in his car and drive immediately.
Where to?
And he's like, well, that's weird. And he lay carefully on his bed because he's like, surely this feeling will go away. But the urge to get in the car and start driving was even more intense. Now, he didn't know where. It was just this urge to get in the car and go. He'd never felt this before. Like, what a weird feeling to just, you got to go. You got to get in your car and go. And he was scared. He was terrified of this feeling. And this urge to drive and the pounding in his chest just would not subside. So he relented. He thought, if I just go and drive my car, you know, it'll just be a silly thing, but at least I'll be able to follow this urge. So he goes out and he's walking across the gravel to his car, gets in, starts the engine, and his heart stops pounding. But he still feels this powerful urge to go driving, and it's now mixed with a sense of urgency. And all of this emotion and feeling is so powerful, he just sits in his car and starts crying.
This guy sounds like, and it makes me wonder if something else has happened to him. I mean, not necessarily in combat, but maybe in the course of his duty, because it sounds like he's actually suffering from a panic disorder. Like
some
everything,
kind of PTSD.
Yeah, he's like describing, look, I mean, yeah, certainly there could be something of the phenomena that's occurring here. But at the moment, from what I'm hearing, apart from, you know, seeing the entity, maybe this is just PTSD, panic disorder, depression, all kind of bumbled up with him reading too much about this phenomena and it's just completely consuming him.
Well, the fact that he's been reading cases where someone suddenly has an urge to drive out
exactly.
to the middle of nowhere and then they're abducted by a UFO is obviously adding to his anxiety, but he's sitting in his car realizing this is madness. He puts the truck in reverse and he backs out of the driveway and he puts the truck in drive and he pauses and he's starting to think, yeah, this is unhealthy. Like, I'm going on this wild goose chase in the middle of the night because of something that exists only in my head. Surely this is just going to drive me to madness. This is insane. And he wipes his tears from his face and he thinks, look, I'm just going to reverse my truck, go back into the driveway. I'm going to get out of the truck, go upstairs, go to bed and forget about this whole thing. As soon as he has that thought, he feels one of the most uncomfortable sensations he's ever felt in his life. The only way he can describe it is he's electrocuted. Now, he's touched live wires before, and it's that buzzing feeling going through his entire body. Now, it's not painful, but it's incredibly disconcerting. This horrible buzzing shooting through his body like he's attached to a light switch or something. He can feel his toenails buzzing.
But you know that those electrical shocks are actually clinical indications of panic disorders
right.
and anxiety.
Right. So he steps on the gas pedal and actually, no, he says involuntarily his foot hit the gas pedal. Then involuntarily his hands started steering the wheel to start to go towards a destination. Something had taken over his body and was now driving the truck out onto the road. Now, he slams on the brakes again and gains control and just says, what the hell is happening to me? His entire body is shaking with fear and he's feeling, again, this strong sense of urgency. And finally, he relents. He's like, okay, I'm going. I'm just going to go. And he just starts driving. Now, he doesn't know where he's going. As he drives down the road, he's kind of wiping the tears from his face and he's trembling, but he starts to feel euphoric. This sense of euphoria sweeps through his body and he says, it felt like I was being rewarded for doing...
For compliance.
Yeah, for compliance, exactly. He said, I figured I would drive down to the river and I'd been there earlier. It seems like a nice place to go. And he decided to stop at the gas station to get a drink because it was quite a long drive to get down there. So he pulls into the gas station and, you know, parks at one of the pumps and his heart starts to pound again. And he's like, what the hell's going on? So he freezes. And this feeling comes over him that whatever made him leave the house had taken him to this gas station. Like it suddenly occurs to him that the gas station was the destination. He doesn't know why, but just this feeling. And he's frightened by this feeling. Now, he starts looking around thinking, what's going to happen at the gas station? Am I going to get shot or something? But he looks out the side windows and he can't really see anything. But then all of a sudden, he sees it. He had parked right in front of it and it was clearly out of place. Now, the gas station also sold fried chicken and it had tables on the sidewalk and, you know, people could sit down and eat. And the place was a mess. It was like chicken bones and trash and empty boxes everywhere. It was just a mess. And he says, given the time of night and the location, because this is a pretty low rent, you know, service station chicken shop, right? He said, there's no way I should have seen what I was seeing. Actually, even the daytime, it would have been incredibly weird.
What's he seeing?
Seated at the table at this filthy fried chicken joint is three people. There's a man and two women dining together on their fried chicken. Now, the man is clearly homeless. He is the most homeless guy you could imagine. And the two women are immaculately dressed supermodels. Like, they look like perfect tens. And they look like, he says, they look like a lot of the civilian women I work with in terms of what they're wearing. And, you know, they're dressed in smart, professional manner. Their hair's all done. They've got perfect makeup, beautiful faces. And it's like, there's no way they're going to be sitting down at this shitty chicken shop having their chicken with the homeless guy. And the homeless guy is like caked in dirt and his hair's got shit in it and he's got like, his hands are all black. Clearly he smells horrible. And these two supermodels are just sitting next to him, like happily eating their chicken. Like, he says it's just the most bizarre, nonsensical thing he's ever seen in his life. And he's actually afraid to get out of the truck because he knows that there's just something completely wrong about this scenario. It's just the uncanny valley. But he ultimately hears a voice in his head say, get out.
Like, get out from where?
Get out of the truck. Get out of the truck. So he's like, collects himself. He, with a trembling hand, he opens the door and gets out of his truck, shuts the door. And as he's slowly, like, consciously walking across the parking lot, he's terrified of what's happening. And he walks past the table where the bum and the two Victoria's Secret models are sitting. And he just describes this homeless man, like, literal caked with grime and dirt. And his ankles have grass and his hair's got, like, stuff growing in it. It's just disgusting. And he describes one woman like she's a light-skinned African-American woman, short, straight hair, but not a hair out of place. Like, she just looks
immaculate.
Perfect. And he describes what she's wearing, which is this really smart kind of business attire. And the other woman is Hispanic. She's got long hair pulled into a bun, pearl earrings, but she also looks immaculately perfect. And remember that it's like midnight or 1 o'clock in the morning at this stage. And as he walks past them, the African-American woman lifts her hand and points to the homeless man and starts to speak. And with her arms stretched out, she says, you see, there's no such thing as chance. Everything happens for a reason. I never sit at places like this, but something told me to sit here tonight. Riddle me this. Almost as if it's all a play. For him, it's like some kind of weird, it's some kind of weird act. And the homeless man is just like, rah, 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 eating his chicken, just like oblivious to what's going on. Yeah, just muttering to himself. And he just walks past, he's like, okay. He goes into the store and he buys a soda and takes a deep breath and thinks about what this woman just said, clearly for his benefit. And it suddenly hits him. The woman's telling me to read the Kybalion.
That's a bit of a jump, though. I mean,
because remember the Kybalion says
all about
that
everything being happening for a reason.
Nothing happens by chance. And then this woman just says, as he's walking past,
there's a lot of scenario building going on there.
And the whole coincidence with the electrical shock, bringing him to the gas station for this moment, he knew he had to start reading the book the next day.
Can you see what this is lining up with, though? I'm actually beginning to think that this guy is having genuine experiences, but it's not good. It's so typical of this phenomena that messes with me. Why get someone into a panic attack to drive out to a gas station at 1 o'clock in the morning to see such a surreal sight of a woman instructing you to read a particular book? There's a whole heap of other ways that you could do it by still staying at home.
Yeah, but the idea is that it can't be that blatant. Like, you can't get a text message saying, read the Cabalion.
But he could simply turn on the television and there could be an ad, you know, that would somehow throw the word in.
Oh, is that easier to orchestrate, is it?
I would say so. Much easier than driving out to a service station in the middle of the night.
Yeah, but the idea is whatever force was able to manipulate him was also able to manipulate the two attractive young professional women and get them to go to the chicken shop. Like, they would have woken up in the middle of the night going, oh, my God, I've got to get some fried chicken. Like, right now, I'm going to get some fried chicken. And they got in the car, they drove, and they found themselves at the chicken shop, and then they started eating fried chicken and started talking about whatever he needed to hear.
But it would have been even more than just simply waking up in the middle of the night and drive. To be that immaculately dressed, it would have taken them a long time. Yeah. It would have taken hours to get ready.
And I got
to
get ready for this fried chicken.
Yeah.
I got to make myself look good.
Yeah, you can put your face on. I mean, it would take a long time.
So the next day he finds a copy of the book online and he starts reading it and finds all these lines that seem to resonate with him and, you know, the hair on his the back of his neck.
Fried chicken somewhere in there, and he knew that meant to be.
Yeah, he says, one passage says, the passage of this book is to those who are ready for the instruction, and it will attract the attention of such as are prepared to receive the teaching. And likewise, when the pupil is ready to receive the truth, then will this little book come to him or her, such as the law. The hermetic principle of cause and effect in its aspect of the law of attraction will bring lips and ears together, pupil and book in company, so mote it be. So for him, this was a big deal. And later it said, if you are a true student, you will be able to work out and apply these principles. If not, then you must develop yourself into one, for otherwise the hermetic teachings will be as words, words, words to you. So the book was a hard pill to swallow for him, but over time of reading it, he realized that his mind was starting to change, and he said he started to enter into the belly of the beast.
Uh-oh.
Because he wasn't prepared for how not only reading this book, but accepting its principles into his life would almost completely destroy him.
Right.
And it's almost like he's tested in the darkness, because the incident that led him to read the book was weird and kind of scary in itself, being controlled to go on a drive. But he said, for the next several months, I was a 39-year-old male that slept with the lights on because the dark terrified me. So his hyper paranoia increased 100-fold. After reading this book and entertaining these principles. At times, he would open his eyes and fight to push himself out of bed, but there was some unseen hand pushing him back into the nightmare. It's like it was really an external force.
It's got hold of him.
Thrusting this upon him.
Yep.
He said, I felt as though my body weighed 1,000 pounds as I would collapse right back into my night terrors and was just in a horrible place mentally. Then one night, at some point, he woke up and he could feel a hand touching his arm. And he opens his eyes, and the first thing he sees is the window off to his left, and everything's kind of fuzzy and out of focus, and he realizes he can't move. But he can still feel this hand just on his right arm, like something's feeling him. And it felt as though his emotions were paralyzed as well, because he wasn't really that scared. But eventually he was able to turn his head around, and he can see this dark, shadowy outline of someone or something standing bent slightly near his bed. And they start to look closer and start looking into his face. He can make out two arms, a torso, a head, and he can make out the room behind this very tall, shadowy figure, because it's starting to light up with this strange golden light. Now, he sees the being begin to lean back and away from his face. And it was as though this figure had a light source on its back, like it was some kind of machine on this figure's back. And the whole while, it's still got its hand on his arm, which is kind of keeping him paralyzed to a degree. But he looks up at its face, and suddenly this image appears. Now, when I say image, he describes it as kind of the being suddenly has a face where there wasn't a face before. Before it was just an outline of this dark figure, but suddenly there's a face there. But it's like an extremely high definition screen. He can tell that it's not a real face. It's like you know, a simple thing would be to say, imagine I just got an iPad with a face on it and put it up to my head. It kind of looks like that in a weird way. He could tell it's not real.
I wonder if it's like a weird holographic projection or something.
But it's, yeah, it's this ultra high resolution display over the being's face. And all these pictures start rotating through the face of people he knows. And it keeps going. Like, it's rotating through his family. It's rotating through colleagues, through friends. And finally, it stops on a picture of an ex-girlfriend of his from 20 years ago. And it's not like he was fooled that it was his ex-girlfriend. He remembers thinking, like, I'm not going to fall for this. Like, I know that you're not my ex-girlfriend. I know that I'm just looking at a high-resolution iPad on your face. Like, what the hell is going on? And then he loses consciousness. He starts to drift off. Now, there's this weird continuation of consciousness where he starts having this immediate sexual dream with that same ex from 20 years ago. And in the dream, it's weird because it's like him and his ex in complete darkness. Like, there's no floor, there's no bed, but they're having sex. And everything about it feels 100% real. Like, he's feeling everything in the dream. And he knows it's not right, so he starts to fight it. And he opens his eyes and starts to regain consciousness. And he realizes he's in his bedroom and there's actually a female on top of him. There's a woman on top of him. And this woman has blue skin, like bright blue skin.
Is she another sex bot?
Well, it's funny because the last time we spoke about the Peter Curry encounter with those two weird aliens showing up in his bedroom and trying to have sex with him, I remember, you know, we just recently found another case that had similar,
similar tones to it.
Yeah, a similar kind of case to the Curry case. And I remember saying on the show, what? There's another Curry-style case? That's bizarre. I thought that was the only one.
And here's more.
And here we have it again. This weird blue female entity is on top of him. He said, I could see her legs were straddling me. My hands were on her legs. I could feel her skin. And it wasn't like human skin, he said. It felt thicker and tighter than ours. He could see a belly button and he could even see the layer of fat under her skin. Like, she had slight cellulite dimples.
But it was artificial?
No, it's like a real being. You can see it. It doesn't look artificial. It's just not human. And she was wearing a top. Like, she was actually wearing clothes on top. And she had red and silver stripes in this vertical zigzag pattern on whatever she was wearing. But it's funny because he describes it as just the most ornate, expertly crafted piece of clothing he's ever seen. Like, these little beads look like fine jewels or something. Like, he just wouldn't believe it if he saw it in a store. And the way her top glistened from the light from the TV in his room, he thought they must be precious metals or something. It was just mesmerizing. And during this experience, it was obvious that she didn't want him to see her face because there was some kind of outline of her face and this large black mass surrounding her. And it was almost as if this black mass, you know, was kind of camouflaging her, like it was actively hiding her face from him.
Or her true form.
Well, he's wondering, is this alien technology? Is her face too shocking? Would I die if I saw it? He just has no idea what's going on. And at one point, he could feel her breath on his face.
It's like the technological equivalent of a brown paper bag.
Yeah, exactly. And he remembers thinking that, you know, I can't believe this is happening. I know she's not human. There must be a craft parked in my backyard. Like, he just thinks, I'm having sex with an alien. Now, he climaxes, obviously, and says in the book, she clearly wasn't going to leave without that. He got the sense that that's why this blue woman was there. And the next thing he remembers is he's waking up the next morning.
So how does he know that it wasn't a dream, a very vivid dream? Does he analyze that at all?
Well, because he wasn't asleep while it was happening.
Right, okay.
You know, he was wide awake. And he goes downstairs and, you know, checks that his truck is there and not a spaceship. And he's just confused and just angry. He's angry at the whole thing because essentially he was raped.
That's exactly what it is. Yeah.
And he couldn't even tell anyone. Like, who do you report that to? So the next day he's going over the events from this night, everything that happened with this strange blue woman. And it suddenly hits him like a stack of bricks. This isn't the first time this has happened. Like, it finally clicks.
Here we go.
And he remembers he must have been about 26 the last time this happened. He was in a condo with two co-workers, and he talks about being home alone. His co-workers were out one evening, and he was sitting on the couch in the living room and just started to drift off to sleep. And suddenly he was having a nightmare where he was running through complete darkness, kind of like the scenario in the dream where he was having sex with his ex, but there was just darkness all around and something was chasing him and it was grabbing at him from the darkness. And occasionally he would get a glimpse of its arms, and the arms were covered in this weird green skin, and it had these long fingers on each hand, and he remembers there only being three digits and an opposable thumb.
Yep.
And the fingers had really bulbous knuckles and they were incredibly long.
Some weird frog alien.
Well, he just assumed it was this horrible nightmare, and he woke up on the floor in the sunroom where he fell asleep. But as soon as he opened his eyes, he realized like the wind was knocked out of him. He couldn't see very well. And he slowly turns his head to his right and sees a face that is clearly not human. It looked somewhat human, he said, but it had really weird pale skin, this large wide nose with ridges on it, and its eyes were human in size, but clearly not human eyes. Mm. And it had this little tiny little mouth, and it just sees him looking at it, and it just goes, just hisses at him. And he says he saw these little pointy teeth when it hissed. It appeared to be wearing something on its head that was like a metallic kind of headband thing. And
had it been having sex with him at that point? Or he doesn't know.
I don't know if it was having sex with him. It was just doing something to him, maybe. Here's a really weird thing that he says, because he doesn't talk about any of his experiences in the military, but he has this little line here where he says, later, I saw drawings of this being at Holloman Air Force Base and realized this is what the face looked like. Come on, dude.
Whoa. He's seen drawings of it from other abductees.
Come on, dude.
Intelligence reports.
Back up a bit. You're in naval intelligence and you're saying you've seen a drawing of this entity at Holloman Air Force Base?
So this is where things become, well, already it's unusual, but if under his security clearance, he shouldn't be even able to acknowledge that he'd seen something like that, and then he just has.
I don't know. That's all he says, just this throwaway line. And you're like, come on, man. Give me something real.
Well, it's already a massive breach in saying that, if
so
it's true.
Basically, this hideous freak alien is, well, probably about to rape him, and he can barely move. He's got dribble coming out of his mouth, and he tries to escape. Like, he starts dragging himself across the carpet like a slug because he can barely move. And he can still feel the presence of this thing in the room. He actually turns and sees its feet and trousers. It's wearing these dark black trousers. What, do you just expect him to be naked?
Well, I just assumed. I mean, most of the time we hear jumpsuits or they're naked.
And he could feel in the room this intense frustration with him. Like the being was angry at him because he had woken up.
And he's resisting.
And he's crawling across the room. It's like that scene out of Wolf of Wall Street, where he's taken too
getting
many
out of the Lamborghini.
taking too many Quaaludes and he's trying to get out. It's like that, where he's just scraping himself across the carpet, and eventually he just wakes up on the sofa, fully clothed, and he feels gross. Like, he feels disgusting.
It's a pair of trousers just like draped over the back of the lounge.
Yeah, he just feels really gross. And he's dehydrated. You know, all the signs that something's not right, completely groggy and dehydrated.
But this gives us some insight into why he's having these panic attacks whenever he's near this thing. So there must be some repressed feelings going on with this stuff.
Well, because it's the next morning when he's woken up, as he goes downstairs to go get a bite to eat, his neighbor from the condo downstairs just starts yelling at him, going, "What the hell were you guys doing in that apartment last night? All I heard was your kids banging up and down all night. It sounded like they were bowling all night. What the bloody hell were you doing?" And he's like, "I don't have any kids and I just fell asleep," because he still thought it was this crazy dream.
What the hell would be making that kind of noise, though? I mean, what could they
You know
be
exactly
doing?
Well, what would be making that kind of noise,
well,
Aaron. And he did say that his knees were badly, like he had bad carpet burn on his knees.
That's
I don't know what that implies. Well, I do know what that implies.
You don't want to see the mental image I just got. I don't want to see the mental image I just got.
The alien was hissing. Like
no, there's two of them. Was one at the front. They're high-fiving.
That's fucking horrible. How can you laugh at that? That's awful.
That's awful.
But again, like he's overcome with fear because he's remembering all these, you know, things from childhood. Like another example was his mother. He remembers this incident from childhood where he came downstairs and the cops were in his house. And, you know, his mother was really upset and his dad was talking to the cops. And he says to his older brother, he's like, what the hell's going on? And his brother, like, was hesitant to tell him, but eventually said, oh, mum woke up and saw someone in the room with her and she called the police. And he says to his brother, really, what the hell happened? And he said, yeah, she woke up and saw this figure of a man standing in the doorway. She started screaming, grabbed her glasses from the nightstand, and this figure took off down the hallway before she could get them on. But the police could find no sign of forced entry, no idea how anyone could have gotten in the house because everything was locked up.
So no evidence at all.
And he thought back to this and thought, you know, this is weird. Like, this stuff would happen to my mum and I've got all these memories. And then the poltergeist activity starts. Like, he tries to call his brother to, take his mind off things and just have a chat with his family. And there's some force that knocks the phone out of his hand. This happens on multiple occasions. Because he lives with a flatmate. This is back in Washington, D.C. And the flatmate has a dog and the dog is all of a sudden terrified of him.
Mm.
You know, the dog won't look at him. The dog leaves the room whenever he walks in the room. You know, all the hallmarks of maybe spirit possession or this poltergeist stuff tied in. It's really starts to get dark.
Well, you also begin to wonder whether or not he's in his job because of this phenomena as well.
Yeah, right. Well, who knows? Eventually, you know, he feels his covers being taken off him at night and a female voice saying, shh, don't be afraid. And then he just kind of passes out and that's all he remembers, wakes up the next day. So he eventually discovers that the original publisher of the Cabalion also released a ton of books in the early 20th century. There's all this speculation that the authors of these other books were the authors of the Cabalion.
Right.
So he buys a bunch of books from this yoga publishing outprint from like 1910 and just starts reading them. But eventually kind of gives up. Like he feels like he's on some quest to obtain knowledge. And he also feels that maybe he needs to let people know what's happening because he's got this understanding of this big secret that people need to know. But he eventually just gives up and he gets home one night and decides to throw all the books in the garbage. He's like, I'm done with this. This isn't going nowhere. My life's miserable. I hate all this stuff. I'm done with it.
It's too late.
Just chucks everything out. It's kind of what you do with some books we get in the studio. You just chuck them in the bin.
Throw them.
At the end of the
burn
day.
Burn them. I have a big book burning at the end of the day.
But that night he wakes up with this, again, heavy feeling and he's thinking, oh God, what now? And the room slowly starts to come into focus and he can see something standing on the other side of his nightstand. And as it comes into focus, he realizes it's a gnome.
A gnome?
There's a little gnome.
Like a typical style gnome.
A small man, maybe 2 or 3 feet tall, like a little gnome looking man. And he just looks like a garden gnome, he says. He's got like a white locked beard. His hair is locked and white and he's staring in amazement at this gnome and the gnome's looking at him like, eh, you can see me? And the gnome is wearing black sunglasses.
like Yoko Ono or something.
Yeah, like round black sunglasses. And Roberts can see behind the black lenses are these fiery orange coals. Like it's glowing red eyes are behind the sunglasses.
Like the black dog phenomena.
Right, or, you know, or Sasquatch or anything else, Mothman, whatever. And he's staring at this gnome and the gnome starts telepathically talking in his mind. And the gnome says, don't give up. Keep going. And he just says back in his mind, oh, fuck off.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the gnome disappears and he goes back to sleep.
And I get it. Up.
But when he wakes up in the morning, he looks at all these books that are in the trash and he's like, oh, you know what? The gnome is right. I shouldn't give up. And this is where the book takes the cheesiest turn I think I've ever seen. Like it just becomes so cringy and corny.
In what way?
He says, I was on the last 15 minutes of my bus ride when a young African-American family got on the bus. and they had a young baby boy and a toddler, and I could see this young mother. I could feel the love she had for her children. And they were seeing the wheels on the bus go round and round. And I sat and watched this, and I thought, if only we all loved each other as this mother loves her child. What a world.
Get it.
What a world this would be.
The love that a parent has for a child. We get it.
He says, we could if we chose to, but tears rolled down my cheeks because I knew that we don't.
Family's probably looking at him going, what's with this weirdo?
What's with this weirdo? It just goes on like this forever. Like the whole book, it just gets worse and worse from here. Like everything becomes this introspection about the state of the world and humans aren't capable of true love. And it gets really corny.
What I said before about the narcissism element that kicks in here, that this is kind of what's going on. It's like, I have the answers.
I'm so glad you said that, because listen to this. One day, a few days after this, he's driving home from work and he's starting to feel a little bit better. And he starts to wonder, you know, where is all this going? Where's my life going with all this stuff? And he hears a voice in his head, the same voice that said, get out, when he was at the chicken shop. And the voice said, you are to act as a shepherd of mankind.
There you go.
But there is not much time. And he's like, what? What are you talking about? And he's kind of uncomfortable with the biblical tone. And he says, what do you mean not much time? Does that mean I'm going to die? And the voice is like, yes.
That will do.
Yes, that's right. You are going to die. And he asks in his mind, he asks his voice how long he has, if there's anything he can do about it. And the voice just gives him a time frame, says that nothing can be done because he's on borrowed time. Now, what effect would this have if an entity tells you you're on borrowed time?
It would obviously create a sense of urgency, but it may also make you more malleable to whatever they're trying to do to you.
Yeah, exactly. Like, you might think, well, my life is over and the only purpose of my existence now is to follow this mission. And of course, the mission is given by the voice in his head.
Well, he sounds like a modern day contactee.
Yeah, well, it gets kind of weird because he starts to have, synesthesia.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he starts to feel people's emotions around him. And when a thunderstorm comes in, he can feel the thunderstorm and he just starts to feel everything. When he's driving in traffic, he can feel the emotions of all the drivers around him. But later on, he's standing in his room and he's trying this breathing technique and he's taking his pulse, trying to get the timing of his heartbeat. And he realizes that where he puts his fingers on his neck to take his pulse is where his hair has stopped growing.
He's touching his neck that much?
And it's subtle. No. This was after he had his blood clot thing. He came out of the hospital and he realized that there were these two spots on his neck that just hair wouldn't grow anymore and he couldn't figure out what it meant. But as soon as he did this, like he placed his fingers on those spots, he realized, hang on a second, that's exactly where you can feel for my pulse. And when he has this realization, he suddenly recalls the voice in his head saying that he's on borrowed time. And this flash enters his mind and it's nighttime in his room and he's standing at the foot of his bed watching himself slumped over when he had that kind of attack from the blood clot in his lungs. And there's this tall being radiating light standing over him with its two fingers on his throat feeling for a pulse. So he's convinced that...
Why would a being, though, with those capabilities, need to feel for a pulse?
Well, he's saying it's not feeling for a pulse. It's healing him through its two fingers. So that's what actually happened that night in his mind when he had the clots in his lungs. He was meant to die. He actually did die. And this entity healed him. So now he's on borrowed time.
Right. So he also owes him something.
That's exactly right. You just hit the nail on the head.
You see how manipulative they are?
He owes his life to these entities now.
Yep, and so he will do their bidding.
Later on, he wakes up in this weird temple. Like, he has this bizarre experience where he wakes up in a temple and he's in this massive room and there's two giant bonfires lit and there's all these beings in robes, like, filled with white light. It's really bizarre. It starts to sound like this crazy kind of...
sounds like Eyes Wide Shut.
No, it's like a spiritual experience, but it's one of those ascended master style experiences. You know, we've covered those stories where a woman climbs up a mountain and she goes into a secret cave yeah. and then the masters take her through an initiation or something. It's like he's describing that. He's eventually brought to these beings from this grand council and they all have blue skin. So it's like clearly they're the race of entities that sent the horny blue-skinned woman to take his sperm. And yeah, he's in this weird temple and eventually the head, like, being from the council speaks about him or speaks about his mission to him and says, "The life you have chosen does not belong to you. It belongs to all of humanity. Your day of judgment begins tomorrow." And then he wakes up in his bed. So the next day he's back. Remember, the whole time he's still in naval intelligence as this is going on. The next day he's walking in the halls of DC doing his Navy thing. And a spider like shoots across him and he thinks that the spider has some kind of symbolism and he links it back to something he read and it's something that it's got to do with judgment. And he realizes the voice from the councilman with the blue skin had told him that his days of judgment begin tomorrow. And he realizes that I am in this web of destiny, and he interprets it to mean that he has to talk openly about everything because he's a shepherd of mankind now.
So not a good thing for an intelligence officer to have a realization that you have to talk about everything.
So you know what he does? He decides to tell his Navy superiors everything I've told you so far. He walks in to the next naval intelligence briefing and says, "Look, generals, I've got some information to share with you. Last night I saw a gnome in my room, and a few weeks earlier I had sex with a lady with blue skin, and it was glorious."
You know, at face value, and I guess from a ridicule standpoint, immediately I'm like, well, this guy's just going to be completely, you know, classified as a nut job. He's going to get a medical discharge. You know, obviously it's psychiatric and they're going to kick him out. But then a small part of me thinks that, well, we hear so many of these stories of the upper echelons of the military knowing something that's going on. Do they believe him or do they entertain him?
The Navy says to him, you need to go to medical and you need to get checked by a psych immediately.
Right, okay, that was the first choice. Right.
Which is exactly what happens. He goes to the psychiatrist. He doesn't really reveal what the outcome was, but remember at the start of the book, I said that, you know, he was kind of waxing over, or in the foreword, Lovelace was saying how, you know, he left the Navy and because the message was too important and it had to come out. I think he was given a choice. It's like you either retire now, you leave now, or, you know, you're going to be discharged. And that's why he left the Navy. I don't think he had a choice in the end. I think he kind of made the decision, or the Navy made the decision for him. So let me show you where this goes, because you can start to see that someone's mind falling apart. I mean, that's really what it comes across to me.
It's obviously not the same thing, but what he's describing and this process he's going through, it sounds similar to what happened to Paul Benowitz.
Yeah, right.
It sounds like this kind of structured emotional breakdown. And I wonder, is there some, because this guy was involved in this incident, like we know that he was, at least he claims that he was, he's claiming that he was a military officer. So is it though that he did see something he wasn't supposed to see? And so they are deliberately feeding him disinformation and messing with him to completely discredit him.
I don't know. It also just smacks of interference from spirits as well. It does. Destroying him, and that's their goal, and that's what they're getting their kicks out of. But a few weeks later, he's awoken again in the middle of the night, and same thing, he's like got a hand on his shoulder, and the hand kind of pulls him over onto his back, and this time he's fully conscious, and he looks up and sees a face staring down at him. And this being runs its hands through his hair and it telepathically tells him, "Don't be afraid." And he's like, "I'm not afraid." Because at this stage, he's kind of overcome his fear of these experiences. And the being looks surprised. The being's like, oh, well then come with me. And it actually, in this really happy, upbeat manner, grabs his hand, lifts him out of bed. And he notices that when it grabs his hand, it's wearing an oven mitt.
What, from his kitchen?
That's what I thought at first, like one of his oven mitts. No, it's just the shape of it. He's wearing some oven mitt. It's wearing a gray suit. And the body shape, he says, these entities, they're Teletubbies. Like, there's a Teletubby alien that is very happy that he's awake and not scared and takes him out of his bed.
Does it have a shape on its head?
I don't know if it's got a shape on his head, but it had really short legs, big kind of round tummies and big square heads. It just looked like a Teletubby. Like the shape was spot on. And the fact that it had tiny little legs didn't matter because they were floating through the air as it was floating him out of his bedroom, down the stairs and into the kitchen. And he said this entity, while he was still holding the oven mitt hands, it just waited at the back door of the kitchen like it was waiting for something. And he watched as its breathing and said it was weird because its breathing was really rapid, like it's faster than human beings. And then two other beings came out of his roommate's room in the apartment. And they looked identical to this other Teletubby entity. There's two other Teletubbies come out. And as soon as they see him with the main Teletubby in the kitchen, one of the other Teletubbies is like, "Oh, wow." And the other one goes, "Ooh." Like they have this kind of weird childlike glee that there's a human standing in the kitchen with their other Teletubby friend.
But it also sounds very clownish.
Yeah, it's fucking crazy. And he says, "It was clear they were amazed to see me, but I know they were in my roommate's room collecting DNA because they had these devices in their hands, and it looked like a railroad spike, and the other one had a gray container with a lid on it. Like they were extracting something. What kind of DNA were they extracting? It wasn't hair samples. It wasn't a skin scoop. We all know what's in that little cup. Imagine what that guy was dreaming about.
Androgyny.
You wake up and there's this massive fat Teletubby but it's got your ex-girlfriend's face. And you're like, "Yeah, I'm falling for this. Why not? Get on."
With some fake box shoved up your junk.
There's another one. There's another one with the cup ready to collect. But it gets the face wrong and it's your dad or something.
Uh-oh, telly bye-bye.
Ridiculous, right? So these Teletubbies come out and he waves at them and says, "Oh, hello." And they instantly feel at ease and they say in this really cheerful manner, "Oh, hello, friend." And they seem so friendly and so innocent and so childlike, he says. Now, the four of them float out of the kitchen door and there's a football-shaped aircraft or saucer outside and they all get inside. And
him included?
Yeah, he gets on inside. Now, he has got a vague memory of what occurred during this flight, but basically has a vibe that it was a very pleasant conversation. I think they spoke about his flatmate's dog and how much the dog loved his flatmate and how happy and friendly they were to have him on board the craft. Like, it was just a general fun get-together with three Teletubby aliens. And no one spoke about the little cup of his roommate's jizz that was just on a table nearby. And that's basically the gist of it. Like, he remembers being dropped off back at home and vaguely remembers going upstairs and going to bed and waking up the next day. And he does remember as he was going back into the kitchen door, he looked up at the football-shaped craft and two of them were leaning out going, "Goodbye, friend. Goodbye, friend." And that's the end of his Teletubby experience.
This is surreal.
It just gets so nuts.
It's kind of got a Fortean feel to it, though. It's like this idea of these entities that just, they're all the same entity. They just wear different masks. Yeah. Like they've taken this tact of maybe the sex robot wasn't getting the reaction that they wanted, so they've switched over to these comical entities.
And later he's abducted in his bedroom, but it's like different entities that come.
Again.
And they attach some device to his back, and he says it has a whale song. Like it starts going, and this weird whale song starts coming out of this device on his back.
Doing what though?
And it's basically, he looks down and his body's fully transparent and he can see where his blood's flowing and he can see his bones and his insides. It's like they were scanning his body. And after that, he wakes up in this incredibly lush bed and everything's made of this marvelous copper and the sheets look like they're made of copper. But when you touch them, it's just the softest, most luxurious feeling. And the mattress he's on is just like, oh, it's like the most amazing mattress you could ever imagine. It's made of this weird copper material. And he's about to get up and explore this weird domed room he's in where some being then kind of comes and kisses him on the forehead and says, it's going to be okay, and pushes him back down, and then he wakes up in his normal bed again. All sorts of weirdness like this. And then there's a 300-page interpretation of Jungian archetypes that follows.
Oh, good God. Yeah, we'll skip that.
And then finally this is where I just basically said, okay, that's it. Well, I've got to talk about this story, but I'm going to leave it here. Let me just read it for you. I woke up lying in bed one night as a very tall, thin, all-white being in a fitted black uniform came through my bedroom ceiling riding what looked like a space motorcycle. He actually looks like Jack Skellington from The Nightmare Before Christmas. The ceiling and roof were gone, and I could see the night sky, and I could see a larger craft above the house from which he was descending. And he claims as this being on a space motorcycle came into his bedroom, somehow the space motorcycle like folded up and slid under his bed. And this being stretches out his long legs and lays next to Matthew on the bed. And his skin looked like a vinyl record, like it had these ridges in it, this black, weird black skin. And he's wearing big, dark black glasses. And the being's lying next to him. He's like, why have you been helping me? He says to the being. And the being says, because we heard your calls for assistance. We are pleased that you have been very insistent and persistent in this endeavor.
That's odd.
And then,
what calls for assistance, though? What was he asking for? To understand what's happening?
Yeah, like he's just begging for understanding and wanted to understand what the Kybalion was truly about and wanted answers. And then it's like immediately back to the cringe. We don't hear what that being did to him or with him. It's just immediately back to the cringe where he says stuff like, I started to understand what my life of experience was telling me. My life experience were initiatory as well. And I could see clearly that there were different phases in my life where I experienced things that allowed me to shift direction, integrating the archetypal energies in their fullness. No, dude, you got raped by a blue space bitch. That's what happened to you.
Yeah, don't,
you
again,
got raped.
Trying to make it intellectual, trying to make it Jungian, and it's all an archetype. And no, this is the modus operandi of these entities. If this is true, and I'm now questioning whether or not he's really in the Navy either. Yeah, like, are you even a military intelligence officer?
Know,
is it true? But this is what, if this is true, this is what these beings do. They, like contactees, like these people, they make you feel special. Not because you are special, but because they're getting something from you.
Yeah. Can I read the last thing he writes?
Yeah, of course.
There's a child walking along a beach, and it's littered with thousands of starfish that have washed up on shore. The child is picking up the starfish one by one and throwing them back into the ocean. A passerby sees the child doing this and decides to instill a bit of wisdom. The passerby tells the child, this is useless. There's no point because there's too many starfish and it can't possibly make a difference. The child then picks up another starfish and throws it back into the ocean and says, it mattered to that one. The end.
And P.S. I was that child.
I was that starfish.
Oh, the cringe. Why does
really
it have
bad.
To be so cringe?
He keeps referencing all this music. That comes up when he's like having some enlightening moment where he's realizing something. And it's always from the band Imagine Dragons.
You know
this band? I've never heard of them.
I do, God.
And it's always really bad. Like, here's one.
Yeah.
It's.
Tell me what you think that I can be. I'm the one at the sail. I'm the master of my sea.
And this is always the message for him to keep going. Like, it's inspirational that this comes on his Spotify account.
Okay, that kind of makes me go,
What?
Not so sure that this guy is fully on the level.
Yes, I don't know if this guy coming forward with his story will help the UFO research world.
You know what? The truth lies in the fact as to whether or not he really is a military intelligence officer. Because obviously if he's lying about that, I guarantee you he's lying about everything. That's where you could find the truth.
Yeah, I mean, I would be more interested in the story if he just laid out his experiences without 300 pages of Jungian archetypes. And I mean, it really
most of which has been debunked.
It really is over the top how he tries to weave the philosophy in and out. And what bothers me the most about it is that he's abused. He's like an abused individual.
Yeah.
And
who can't see it?
He's treating it like it's some kind of sacred initiation. And, you know, he's being brought into this higher spiritual, like he talks about how his consciousness is unlocked and how his consciousness is being upgraded. And, you know, all that usual
it's very
fluff.
New age. Yeah.
And again, it's like, dude, no, you've been abused. Like, you're terrified for a reason. It's because you're being abused.
So what do you think is happening? I mean, I'm getting the impression that you think it's low level entities.
Yeah, it might be. I might be aliens. I don't know. I'm seriously questioning the guy's sanity.
Yeah.
Towards the end.
Yeah.
I did like the Teletubbies, though. I want to believe in them.
Well, you know what, though? Some of this stuff is just so completely outrageous that it does leave this thread in your mind of going, is this just all garbage? Is this guy making it up? But coincidentally, I happened to be reading a story today because I was going to go down this path of World War II kind of experiences. And the reason why I did that is because after I was looking into those stories of there being the dark side of Cupid, Nick Redfern has actually written extensively on this, as has, I believe, Jonathan Downs has touched on some of this stuff, and even Brent Swanser. But you find, from going from incidents like Mothman to certain forested locations in the UK, even here in Australia, there's reports of there being Lovers Lane ghosts. And Nick has drawn this kind of conclusion that, you know, or this inference, I'm sorry, it's not a conclusion, but there's something about human amorous behavior that seems to not only attract these things, but also somehow open up a portal of some kind, allow these things to come through.
Remember, that's what Spoon Guy said. What's his name again?
Uri Geller.
Ingo Swan.
Oh, Ingo Swan, right.
Ingo Swan or Uri Geller? Ingo Swan. He said that—
It's probably Ingo Swan.
In another dimension, that when people were having sex, it was like a massive lighthouse.
Yeah.
It was like a beacon.
Yeah.
Spirits like moths would be drawn to this flame on another plane.
Well, there was a report even as recently as 2016 that I think it was Nick that was referencing. And it was this story of this woman that, or a guy that was describing that he'd gone to a lover's lane somewhere and he was obviously, you know, doing the deed with his girlfriend. And his girlfriend flipped out because she was saying, oh my God, there's a guy over there wearing a monkey suit and he's watching us. And apparently he looked over his shoulder and he's like, that's not a guy wearing a monkey suit. It was like this Bigfoot that was like, oh, kind of touching himself, watching.
It's like, touching himself.
Oh, but I just added that on the end. But still, like, these things seem to be perverts of some kind. But the strange thing about that report is that as outrageous as it sounds, it happened in a location, unbeknownst to the witnesses, that has got a long history of Lovers Lane ghosts, of entities showing up. In that location, there's been reports of white apes. There's been reports of lizard-style beings being there. There was even one report from that in that vicinity of where a guy had fired a shotgun through his windshield when one of these entities had climbed onto his car. It was like a Bigfoot-style, shaggy kind of creature. So why are these things attracted to it? But
there's only so many times you can use a raccoon as a fleshlight.
And you know what? Bigfoot would do that too.
Yeah, of course he does.
You just know he would. You just know he's filthy. But no, as I was, you know, going through that, I know we're running a little bit long, but I just want to mention just a couple of these cases for you, because what really, you know, hit the nail on the head for me was when you were describing that when he woke up to find this blue woman, you know, having sex with him, but that how she was wearing the clothing and was wearing this intricate, delicate, whatever, you know, description he had of the clothing. I thought, that's weird. And the same with the trousers. It's like, why are these beings wearing clothes?
I guess I would ask, why do you expect aliens to be naked all the time?
Yeah, well, I guess because when we hear greys, like, they're always naked.
Well, not always.
Not always. Jumpsuit is the other thing that kind of pops up. But you don't really hear of entities wearing anything else. Like, trousers is unusual. You know, like jumpsuits you get, but trousers is kind of strange. And, you know, beautiful dresses and that kind of stuff, it's just a little bit odd. Normally there'd be like a shawl or a cape or something.
The thing I don't get with aliens and what they wear is, where's their luggage? You never hear about backpacks or even a bum bag.
You get the occasional bum bag, but they're normally carrying some apparatus with
it. It's just on their belt. Like, where's their stuff? You know, you'd expect that they've come a long way. Where's their day pack? They don't even have a bottle of water with them.
They've probably got like that idea of transporter buffers. You know, like the idea of like Star Trek, how they've got transporters?
No.
Well, basically it's this idea that so you can carry everything. when you transport something, you basically just put it into a buffer somewhere. So it dematerializes, it's in a buffer, and when you need it, it just rematerializes. So maybe they've got that kind of technology, but maybe that answers the question. But the reason why I raise it is today, as I was going through all these reports, I happened to come across this report that was from World War II. It was 1944, and it was where the Russians and the Nazis were clashing on this disputed region. And the Nazis apparently were being quite difficult. Even though it was getting towards the end of the war and the Nazis were losing, they were sending in these scout groups that were going into these Russian territories. And there was a really remote region on the border. And this area had basically, it was reported that there was like the equivalent of a local Russian sheriff who essentially was part of the Home Guard, whose job was to go out every day on these patrols and look for potential Nazi scout groups coming through, or listen to the townsfolk reporting strange incursions coming from the Nazis. But on this particular day, he got this report of a unusual Nazi soldier that had headed through. And it was described as being, the townsfolk thought it was the Nazis, but they were saying it was like this really large man. It was like a really, really big man wearing what appeared to be like this thick kind of camouflage. And so obviously this Russian sheriff goes, okay, that's something that we obviously have to investigate. We need to look into that. So they go up into the mountains, into the hills where these Nazi soldiers had previously come through. They don't find any Nazis. But all of a sudden, this thing kind of springs up and goes running. It's kind of, so we know who it is.
Yeah.
It's a Bigfoot. Like, it's this Bigfoot, and it's abundantly clear that this is not a human being. This is a Bigfoot that's running past. And these guys, for a moment, are shocked and paralyzed by it. Like, they're absolutely trying to comprehend what they're seeing. It's the middle of the war, so the last thing you're thinking about is a Bigfoot. You start thinking, is this some type of uniform that it's wearing? Is it some type of high altitude equipment or something to keep them warm? Just all these things are going through their minds, and they snap out of it because they realize the surreal nature of what's occurring before them. But they start chasing after this Bigfoot, these Russian soldiers or these Russian Home Guard. And as they're running after it, they said what grabbed them is it appeared that this thing actually had an intelligence to it. Now, we know that Bigfoot is a bumbling fool, but he did seem to have an intelligence to him.
Yeah.
And he makes a beeline for a hunter's hut. Like, they see this Bigfoot running, and all of a sudden it's like, it's looking around. It sees the hunter's hut. It's like, and runs into the hunter's hut, opens the door, goes inside, and slams the door, right? So they're like, we've got him. We've got this guy. And they realize, it was actually said that they realize that they have to capture this thing alive. Like, they have to get it. This is unprecedented. It's an amazing thing. We have to go in and get this thing. So they apparently sit down because they know that there's only one way out for this thing, and they figure that if they can encircle this hunter's little hut, they'll be able to trap this thing. They've all got weapons. Hopefully they don't have to shoot it. They just have to capture it. But it's almost like this thing can read their minds. And we have heard of the etheric nature of Bigfoot and, you know, all this weird telepathy and kind of high strangeness associated with him. So it is suggested here that somehow the Bigfoot knows what their plan is, because right as they're about to pounce on the house, apparently the door comes flying open, and running from it is a Bigfoot in an intricate caftan, like little tassels, like a full-on caftan.
What is a caftan?
It's like it's kind of like a burqa, but with the full face showing. It's like they're really beautiful gown kind of things. This Bigfoot is wearing a woman's caftan with sequins, running from this, and he disappears. Like, the men are so like shocked seeing this Bigfoot wearing clothing, none less than a caftan, that they all kind of go, and they stop for a moment. Bigfoot's gone. Disappears.
Genius.
So is it...
Like, is he actually the smartest dumb animal in the world?
Well, I mean, you ask, where's all their luggage? Like, did the Bigfoot just go into this hut and was like, I looked around and just found a caftan, and like the whole time he's trying to fit into this thing? Or did he somehow have it with him? And like, was this the residence of the Bigfoot? It's just, it's a surreal and strange story. And obviously, because it's coming out of the war, you know, it's a very much, you know, hotly contested. But it's not unprecedented because, you know, Nick Redfern himself has pulled up plenty of reports. I think Jason Offutt has as well. Reports of strange, hairy creatures, Bigfoot nonetheless, wearing
full burkas.
No. Not Phil
you
Perkins.
You see the eyes, but you know it's him. You know it's him under there.
Apart from the fact that he's 8 feet tall, yeah. Like you can just see shaggy feet underneath. It's like, it's not really a camouflage,
he's
is
like,
it?
Like, oh, walk, walk.
Tries to give you dates and coffee.
Yeah.
No, it's like, it is, but there are plenty of reports of their big Bigfoot wearing clothing. You know, wearing trousers, yep. Wearing shirts, checkered shirts. And then, of course, it ties in with the other stories that people have described of the home invaders, the bedroom invaders, where they wake up in the middle of the night to find a lumberjack. Like these. So there's, as much as that story is crazy, with the guy saying he woke up to that woman wearing clothing that was, you know, beautiful, maybe there is something to it. I mean, maybe he did have a genuine experience, or he, you know, as you said, Ben, he's just spent all this time reading all of this phenomena. And if you read enough of it, you can start to see the connections, and so you can throw it in for your story. So maybe that's what this guy has done. But what he's saying, it's not that unusual.
I really want to know what happened on the warship. Like, I want to know why he's so emotional and all that detail. And what happened to Holloman Air Force Base, where they've got sketches of weird skinned
You took the word
entities.
Right out of my mouth, because for me, that's what makes me think that he's unfortunately not telling the truth. Because if you're in intelligence, like, I don't think people realize, it's like it is drummed into you that you cannot in any way or in any form talk about this stuff. So for him, unless he's just had a complete lapse of judgment, but what I'm saying is it's trained into you. So for him to give it away like that, to say, oh, well, I just happened to see drawings of aliens, it's a pretty big red flag.
If you look at the public Navy website, he is listed as a commander.
Okay. Interesting. So maybe...
Oh, no, that's a native of Sydney, Australia. That is not the Commander Matthew Roberts that I'm looking for.
Right. So...
No, that can't be him, because he left in March 2013. Maybe it is him.
So
anyway,
is he Australian?
Kind of a research I should have done before doing the segment.
We'll do it next time, then. It's fine.
Yeah, I'm sure we will.
It was all good for the Teletubby story.
I'm sure we will.
That's the whole point. So yeah, we'll go into the Hito Bashira a little bit later on. We'll come back
cool.
to that.
Well, the book is Initiated, UAP, Dreams, Depression, Delusions, Shadow People, Psychosis, Sleep Paralysis, and Pandemics. I left off the full title at the start of the show, by Matthew Roberts. I'll link to it in the show notes if you want to pick it up. There is some fun stuff in there, and maybe you'll get a kick out of all the Jungian archetypes. Who knows? That's a wrap for this Plus edition. Thanks for listening. Thanks for being a member, and we'll catch you on your next show on Friday. See you then.